Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, you can make sure to register for Here We Still Stand next year. Now, I'm not going to bring this up constantly like I do. I'll wait a little while. Eventually, I will bring it up constantly. But I'll just bring it up right now just to let you know that registration for Here We Still Stand 2022, the National Conference in San Diego, we are going back. We're doing the big thing. The registration for that is open, and you probably want to register before January 1st. Because that's when the price goes up. So you can get in on the early bird rate. It includes all your food. If you've been to Here We Still Stand, you know what kind of deal this is. So Chad will be there. I'll be there. You can check out the whole roster. It's going to be a blast. It's a year away. Go ahead and just get that ticket. You can get your room later. You can get your plane later. Grab the ticket. Mark it on your calendar. We'd love to see you. We just got done, Chad, being out in Las Vegas.
For the
regional event, and that was a lot of fun, man. It was a good time. The great church, great people out there, and went real well. If you're a listener, which I know that there was a bunch of people out there that are listeners to this because they told me so, it was great to see all you guys. Thanks for coming out. If you haven't registered for the San Diego event, do it because we'd love to hang out with you again. And today, we're actually wrapping up, Chad, a book of the Bible. We were talking beforehand, our 10th book.
It's of great biblical significance that we're doing this. Not the 9th. It's not the 11th. It is the 10th book.
Yeah. The only way it could be better if it is when it was the 7th book. I guess maybe the 12th book has some biblical significance too. But 10. Nice round number. This we're about to wrap up the 10th book. So we'll make sure we get through it too.
Yeah, we were trying to figure out beforehand like what percentage of the Old Testament we've gone through, but I've never been that good at math, so I couldn't figure it out quickly. But we're making progress. Let's leave it at that. We're making progress, right? One more book down.
We're still going to be with you for several years.
Yeah. Hang in there. We're not going in retirement until we finish the Old Testament.
That's right.
We got plenty of job security ahead of us for the podcast.
That's right.
Yeah. So we wrapped up last time with this long list of David's mighty men. Of course, we went over those kind of strange episodes that described the various accomplishments of some of David's mighty men. And I think I pointed this out at the end of the last episode, that chapter 23 of 2 Samuel ends with an ominous note, ominous at least to some extent. It certainly harkens back to some pretty dark days in David's life. And that is verse 39, last verse of 2 Samuel 23, in the list of David's mighty men, says Uriah the Hittite. And then it says 37 of these guys in all. Of course, Uriah Hittite takes us back to the earlier debacle with David, Bathsheba, and Uriah, and Joab, and the army, and everybody else who was affected by this. And we have, to a large extent, been following the ripple effect of what began on the rooftop the day that David saw Bathsheba. We've been following those ripples all the way through the rest of the book. Now, I like the way that whoever put this book together, the way that they put his name at the end, because by hearkening back to that negative episode in David's life, it acts as a segue to what we're going to cover in this final chapter, chapter 24 of 2 Samuel, because we're going to see once again, David's going to sin. He's going to mess up. And this is in a different sort of way. And there's some ambiguities here as to exactly why what David did was wrong, why it was a sin. We'll talk about that in just a second. But clearly, what he did was that which angered the Lord. And there was huge, huge consequences. Bunch of people dead as a result of not just David's actions, but also Israel was implicated in this as well. So anyway, that's the way 2 Samuel 23 ends with Uriah, and now we're going to transition to this final chapter, which begins this way. I'll just read these first couple of verses. 2 Samuel 24. Again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, "Go, number Israel and Judah." So it's going to be a census, in other words. So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, "Go through all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and number the people, that I may know the number of the people. And then verse 3, Joab said to the king, may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see it. But why does my lord the king delight in this thing? But the king's word prevailed against Joab and the commanders of the army. Let's kind of leave it there. That's about halfway through verse 4. So I guess the kind of the looming question in the background here is what's going on here with God's anger, and why is God inciting David, or what does it mean that he incited David, and what's up with the census? Why does David do it, and why does this end up being such a bad idea? And to all those questions, I will answer, I wish I knew. a cop-out, but there's a lot of ambiguity here because we're not told explicitly kind of what's in the background of all of this.
I think the thing that makes this passage the toughest is that the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel unknown reasons.
Yes, yes.
And that he incited David against the people, saying, go number Israel and Judah. Like, this is the part that makes it like really problematic. Because if it just said that then David decided that he wanted to figure out wanted to number the people of Israel, you and I would have no problem explaining why the Lord didn't want him to do that.
Yeah, it'd be a lot easier, sure.
But
that's not what it says.
Because he's not supposed to do that. But the fact that God incited him to do it makes it a little more difficult.
Yeah, it does. And I don't know that we're going to have an adequate answer to explain exactly what's going on here. First of all, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. Well, some people explain that as reflecting back on some of these incidents we've covered before, you know, whether it's the rebellion of Absalom or whether it's the rebellion of Shimei after that. Perhaps the problem I see with that is because, as we discussed when we started covering these final chapters, there's a lack of sequence here. These aren't in chronological order with regard to David's life. So we don't know for sure when this happened. I mean, we can say that it happened after, for instance, David was king, of course, and after he had captured the city of Jerusalem, because he's in Jerusalem. We can say it was, you know, at that point, after that point in David's reign, but we don't know exactly when this happened, no more than we know some of the other events in these last three or four chapters of 2 Samuel. So whatever the reason was, it was kindled against Israel, and God was using David in order to bring about this action against Israel. And this, of course, is not inconsistent with the way the Lord works in other parts of the Old Testament as well, in which he will, to bring about discipline or punishment upon his people or other peoples, he uses means, and this is the means by which God does this. So, as we've discussed many times, we tend to think of primary and secondary causes of events, but the Old Testament typically refers to God as the one who does these things. It just attributes it directly to God. So God is the one who prevents a woman from getting pregnant. God is the one who strikes down someone. God is the one who does this or does that. Yes, in reality, there's probably all sorts of other reasons and causes that are used by God, but this is the typical way that the Old Testament speaks. So he says, go and number Israel and Judah. And of course, we have Joab's hesitancy. He's being rather polite for Joab here. Maybe this was earlier in David's reign, before the frigid relationship between these two developed. But he's basically saying, listen, David, you know, may God give you a whole bunch more people, but why would we want to do this thing? So the census itself is a bit tricky because we do have other censuses. Is that the plural, census, censuses? I'm not up on my Latin here, but we do have other occasions of a census being taken. Ahab, for instance, took a census in the Book of Kings. And then we have a census taken in the days of the wilderness back in the book of Exodus. So I think the real question is, why would David do this? And there's no clear answer given. Typically, now this particular census, and probably most of the time there was any kind of counting going on. The reason was to determine how many fighting men that you had. Because when we get to the end of this census, we're told how many guys there were who drew the sword. That's in verse 9. So they're not just going through like in a census of, you know, in America, and I guess they do this in other countries as well. You know, how many people in your household, blah, blah, blah. That's not what this is about. They want to know how many soldiers they have. So chances are the impetus behind this had something to do with perhaps an upcoming military campaign, or some commentators will say, well, the reason David did this is because he was wanting to kind of pride himself on how many soldiers he had. Other commentators say, well, the reason he was doing this is for taxation purposes. He was getting ready to tax the people. Any or all of those could be the reason. Now, one reason that is often cited, and even Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, when he retells this story, Josephus says, well, what David did that was wrong here is he disregarded the law of the Torah back in Exodus chapter 30, which says that any time that there was a census taken, that what was to happen was that there was supposed to be a half shekel kind of atonement money that was given by each of these soldiers to cover their transition from kind of the common state to being involved in holy warfare. And there's no mention of David doing this. And so that was David's sin. He didn't exact the half shekel from all these fighting men, as it was said to be done back in Exodus chapter 30. I guess possibly the only problem is there's no allusion whatsoever to this law anywhere in 2 Samuel chapter 24. And you would think that if David did break the law in Exodus 30, that would be cited or at least alluded to in some way.
Yeah, well, it seems like the best I can do here, Chad, is say that the Lord wants to know how many people. I mean, it's not as though he doesn't know, but he's going to have David count up the amount of people that there are in Israel and Judah. The only thing I can see is that David doesn't just number the people, but he divvies them up. He figures out, he doesn't just find out like a grand sum of the amount of people, but he figures out, how many fighting men do I have? And he wants to know some, well, you know, it's sort of, well, as long as we're going to count the people, let's go ahead and figure out how much of this we got and how much of the other thing we got and all the stuff. And that seems to be possibly the thing that God did not like. God's maybe saying, like, I didn't tell you to do that. Yeah. I just told you to figure out the population. I wasn't trying to let you were. I wasn't telling you to figure out how big your army could be or anything like that. And it seems that, you know, our buddy Joab, for whatever reason, knows that this is a bad idea.
Yeah, he's very, very cautious about this. In polite language, which, like I say, is kind of unusual for Joab, since he typically is blunt with David. But in polite language, he's basically saying, "Listen, I wish that Israel, you know, were." Way bigger than it actually is. You know, may this happen, but let's not go counting them. So there is this built-in fear or hesitation around doing this, and rightly so, as we will see from the effects of this particular case. So once more, you know, we see Joab thinking correctly. Not that Joab always thinks correctly, but very often he does. Very often he's actually the guy who has a clear head in the room and not David. And if David would have listened to Joab, a lot of people's lives would have been spared as a result. But he didn't. David once more rejected the kind advice, the sage advice of Joab, and proceeded with this. So we don't know exactly what this anger was, the reason God was angry, nor do we know precisely the exact sin that's involved, but I suspect it has to do with David acting sort of in a Pharaoh sort of way. And the reason I say this is because there's a lot of Exodus language that's embedded within this chapter. Language of plagues, language of the angel of the Lord, about to destroy a whole bunch of people, the imagery of the sacrifice, placating the wrath of God, all of these are embedded within the Exodus account. So maybe what's going on here is David's kind of not just had a big head, but he's sort of trying to control things, which is typical king fashion, right? He's trying to get a hold of how many people he has so he can kind of use this army in the way that he sees fit. taking it over, as it were, from God.
Yeah.
It's the best I can do.
Yeah, you have to think that it can't be the actual counting, because God told him to do it. It has to be a motivation issue. It has to be that David is not doing this simply because the Lord told him to, but because the Lord told him to, now David has an ulterior motive to do this as well.
Yeah, because once he knows how many men he has, once he knows how big his fighting force is, then yeah, he might get some unholy aspirations to do something that God has not told him to do. So anyway, as that kind of as a lead into all of this, what happens next? Well, the king's word prevails, as I mentioned in that first part of verse 4. And so Joab and his guys basically go out and they do the job. Joab takes all the commanders of his army, and they kind of this big circle route all around Israel. They go out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. Verse 5 says they cross the Jordan, which is interesting. So they're going into the Transjordan, the eastern side of the Jordan. And they go to a place that's about 15 miles, I believe, to the east of Jerusalem, called Aror. I have trouble saying that, like I have trouble saying the word rural. So, rural, Aror, however that goes. It's much easier to say in Hebrew. But anyway, that's where they go, to that Transjordan area, and then they go north from there, working their way up toward Gad and Jazer. They go to Gilead, and then it kind of just documents it in the next few verses. So they go all the way up to Dan, which is the northern part of Israel. Anytime you hear Dan of Beersheba, just picture of north and south. They go to Dan. They go to Sidon, which is along the Mediterranean coast. So they're on the far western side of Israel, to the fortress of Tyre. Presumably there were, of course, some Israelites living around the city of Tyre. And then they start working their way southward. They go to all the cities of the Hivites, the Canaanites. They go all the way down into the Negev of Judah at Beersheba. And there's our Beersheba reference. So they go all the way north to Dan, all the way south to Beersheba. And it took them a long time. This wasn't just, you know, it'll take us a week or two, we'll get the chariots all ready to go, and we'll start counting people. No, this didn't take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 months, 9 months and 20 days. Very precise. 9 months and 20 days to count all of these people in all of these different places, north, south, east, and west. And they came back. Verse 9 tells us that Joab gave the sum of the numbering of the people to the king. And here's how many we ended up with. You got 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword, and then you have 500,000 men of Judah. That's a bunch of people.
Yeah.
So you got these two. It's kind of strange that already before the division of the land, you already have references to Israel and Judah. Because, of course, after Solomon's death, when Rehoboam takes over, that's when you have the split into the northern kingdoms and the southern kingdoms, which are typically referred to as Israel and Judah. But multiple times prior to Solomon, going way back, you have references to Israel and Judah. So these kind of became the pairing by which all the holy people, all the people of God, could be described. So 500,000 men of Judah, 800,000 men of Israel. And as I mentioned, these are not just the people, but these are, in fact, the soldiers.
And that's the part that's interesting, right, is that they don't come back and we're not given, here's the population. We're given, here's how big your army could be.
Here's how big your army could be. It's a pretty good army. I think that they could safely invade Egypt, or they could go north, or they could go to the east. I mean, they got a lot of options with that many men, but it never happened because of what we are told happened next. So this is verse 10. David's heart struck him, we're told, after he had numbered the people. I was curious as to whether David's heart had struck him at some other time. And it turns out this particular Hebrew phrase is only used here and one other occasion, back in 1 Samuel chapter 24. So we're in 2 Samuel 24, but back in 1 Samuel 24, this is when David is still on the run from Saul. Saul is still alive, chasing David all over the place. And Remember, Saul one time had to relieve himself. There was no latrine nearby, but there was a cave. So he goes into the cave, drops his drawers, relieves himself. And when he's in there, David and his men are hiding in the same cave. David sneaks up, cuts off the corner of Saul's robe, and then Saul leaves after he's done his business. And then in 1 Samuel 24, verse 5, we're told afterward, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. So, of course, in that occasion, his heart struck him because he had dared to even come close to doing harm to the anointed of the Lord. In this case, he is the anointed of the Lord. He is the king. And his heart strikes him because once more, I guess maybe because the same language is used, it's kind of this idea of desecration. He's done that which is unholy. He's done that which should not be done. And as an action in the first case directed against the Lord's anointed, so this later action is directed against the Lord, Lord himself. So he confesses. David said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I've done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly." So he makes his confession. Nothing wrong with the confession. It's pretty straightforward. He's not excusing himself or blaming anybody else. He's said, "This is what I've done, and I'm praying that you'll take away my iniquity." So God didn't answer him directly. It's not like a voice boomed down and said, "Here's what's going to happen." But instead, when David got up in the morning, the Lord sent a prophet by the name of Gad. And we've encountered him one other time. So way back in 1 Samuel chapter 22, we're introduced to Gad. At that particular point, we're not told hardly anything about him. He advised David at one point when he was fleeing from Saul. But besides that, we really don't know a whole lot about him. But he's, along with Nathan, one of the prophets at this time, and he comes to David. He's called here, interestingly, a seer, which is a kind of an older term for a prophet. So maybe kind of just some older language used here, or maybe this refers partially to the antiquity of this particular story. But anyway, he's called a prophet or seer. And he says to David, this is what the Lord says. You got three choices, three things I'm going to offer you. Choose one of them that I may do it to you. I'm sure glad God doesn't work this way now. Can you imagine? Preacher shows up at the door, knock, knock, knock. Hey, I know you've been sinning. I got three choices for you. None of these are good. These are all bad. So, and it's not like you can't ask for a fourth choice. Here's your choices. So David, Gad says to David, says, okay, number one, 3 years of famine. Number two, you can flee for 3 months before your foes while they pursue you. Or third choice, 3 days of pestilence in your land. Remember, 3 days basically some sort of attack, some sort of pestilence in your land. So consider and decide what answer I shall return to him who sent me. Whew.
Now,
the choices.
These are three terrible options. This choice seems easy, though.
Well, yeah, the choice does seem easy. First of all, you got three years, three months, three days. Yeah, yeah. Would you rather be afflicted for 3 years, 3 months, or 3 days? Well, that kind of narrows. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of thought, I don't think, that needs to go into this, because I'll take 3 days over 3 months or 3 years.
Yes.
And David has another reason for making the choice that he does. It's not just the shorter nature of the punishment. But here's what he says. And I love this confession. This is verse 14. David says, "I am in great distress." No exaggeration there. "Let us fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercy is great. But let me not fall into the hand of man."
Yeah. Yeah. I think like 3 years of famine, you're like, yeah, we're not doing that. That's not good at all. But I guess you could say like, well, 3 days of pestilence or 3 months of having being pursued by your foes, and you could depend on your own strength and say, well, I did just number the guys. I got a lot of guys. I mean, who's really going to come in here and do that? But David decides that he'd rather roll the dice with God than roll the dice with men, which is probably a good idea.
Yeah, very good idea. Now, you might be asking, what this three years of famine, what does that have to do with, you know, would that be falling into the hands of God? No, because probably what's going on here is, so if your country's in the midst of famine, what are you going to do? Well, you got to rely on other people. You got to rely on the neighboring countries around you. So in that way, you're falling into the hands of men also. So whether they're pursuing you or whether they're, you know, charging you an arm and leg for all the grain that they know you don't have, but that you need, either way, you're falling into their hands. So he says, let me fall into the hands of the Lord for his rachamim in Hebrew, which is mercy, can also be translated as his compassion. Either way, we're talking here about divine love. So let me fall into God's hands, not in the hands of men, because in kind of implied there is their mercy is not great.
Right.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. God's hands, because, well, yeah, it's God's hands and it's not going to be good, but at least he's got great mercy. But if I fall in the hands of men, well, the last thing I'm going to expect is mercy from them. So given the choice, always fall into God's hands, because at least those hands, you know, are going to be compassionate and merciful. So David makes his choice. And what happens is recorded in the next few verses. So verse 15 and following tells us that the Lord sent this plague, pestilence, a dever in Hebrew, on Israel from the morning until the appointed time. Now, we're not told if this appointed time was the third day. Did God lessen the amount of time? It's kind of a strange, ambiguous language that's used here for the appointed time. So however long it was, a bunch of people died. We are told that for sure. So from Dan to Beersheba, there was 70,000 people. 70,000 people who died from this plague. So the death toll is just kind of mind-boggling, trying to imagine what this would have meant for the people of Israel.
Now, I haven't looked at the Hebrew here, Chad. Now, it does say, in the English translation anyway, that 70,000 men, right? And yeah. And I'm wondering, and maybe you can clear this up, is this sort of the way that Scripture sometimes uses the word men, just to describe people in general? Or is this 70,000 men? Is it telling you that 70,000 men died?
It's probably a reference to the men. The word is ish, which is a typical word for man. I mean, it can be used generically sometimes, just like we use men sometimes, kind of in older English generically, but probably this is in reference to not to people in general, but in fact to men.
Yeah, so which, you know, sometimes, you know, the Bible will do this and it'll say, you know, the New Testament does this too. Jesus feeds 5,000 and it'll say men, and then it'll say, you know, plus women and children or something like that. And so it's not uncommon for the Bible to only give you the number of the men involved. However, it could be that as David numbers his fighting force, these are fighting men, that those are the only numbers we're given. It seems to be that those are the numbers he cares about, that God has reduced his fighting force by 70,000.
Yeah, that just seemed exactly what's going on here.
And perhaps this didn't affect women and children at all. Don't know. Yeah. We're not told that it does.
Right, and that's kind of the direction that I lean, just because of the way the story is told. So they count the fighting men. We're given that number. We're told how many men died. So chances are, given the way the story flows, this was restricted to the adult male population. Yep. They were the ones who were.
Yeah, that's how I read it. But then I was like, well, you never know with this Hebrew here. It could just be people. But it seems that in the flow of the story that God says, that's how many men you have. I'm going to reduce your fighting forces by this many, just so you know that I can.
Yeah, it's kind of the whole Gideon story, except in this case, people aren't just going home or not drinking water, right?
Yeah.
they're actually dying. And then we're given this image of verse 16 of the angel or the messenger who has his hand stretched out toward Jerusalem to destroy it. And the parallel to this in Chronicles describes this angel messenger standing between heaven and earth, kind of this giant angel figure. And verse 16 goes on to say, the Lord relented, changed his mind from the calamity, and said to this messenger who was working destruction among the people, stop, it is enough, now stay your hand. And then we're told that the angel of the Lord, now this is the exact same terminology that we have encountered multiple times, especially in the book of Exodus regarding the Moloch Yahweh. So for the sake of consistency, you know, there it's easy to say, oh, well, the angel of the Lord is the second person of the Trinity. It's the word of God who is appearing to Moses in the burning bush, or to Hagar in the wilderness, or who's guiding Israel through the wilderness to the promised land. But there's no reason to say, well, that's the Son of God and this isn't.
Oh, I think this most definitely is.
Yeah, I mean, so it's like,
the reason you think you have to do that is because just not just because you have the angel of the Lord, which is, as we've interpreted this from the beginning, we would say that this is Jesus, but that David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel by speaking to the angel.
Yeah. So I mean, as uncomfortable as this makes people feel, this is actually not inconsistent with even some of the language in the New Testament that refers back to, for instance, the destruction that took place in Egypt on the night of the 10th plague, where there is an allusion to this angel being none other than this messenger being none other than Christ who goes through the land of Egypt. This is another one of these Exodus themes that we see coming up here. So he's standing by the threshing floor of a guy named, another strange name, Arauna, I guess is the way that we would say that in English. I'm not sure. It's another one of those kind of easier to say in Hebrew, but Arauna, the Jebusite. So that's where he's at. David spoke to the Lord when he saw the messenger who was striking the people. And David said, behold, I have sinned and I have done wickedly. So I have. But these sheep, of course, referring to the people that he is shepherding as the king, these of my citizens, my sheep, of which I am a shepherd, what have they done? So please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. David, as it were, steps forward and says, listen, if anybody needs to be punished, it's not all these people, but it's me. So direct your wrath against me. But that's not going to happen either, because everything's about to change. Verse 18 says that Gad, that is the prophet, came to David and said, here's what you need to do. Build an altar. So raise an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of this Arauna, the Jebusite. And that's what David begins to do. So David goes up at this message of Gad, and then we have this conversation that happens between the two of them. So Arauna looks at him, sees the king coming. He goes out to them. He pays homage to them. And then they begin a kind of this back and forth. It's sort of an old style of trying to come to an agreement. And it's very similar, by the way, to Abraham's bargaining that he conducts with the sons of Heth when he's trying to buy the cave of Machpelah so that he can have a burial site for his family. It's the same kind of give and take happens in that conversation that happens here. Because Arauna says, what's my lord the king coming to a servant for? And David says, I'm here to buy the threshing floor from you because I'm going to build an altar to it to stop the plague. And Arauna says to David, well, why don't you just take it? I'll tell you what, I'll just give it to you. In fact, here are the oxen. You can use those for the burnt offering. And here are these threshing sledges and the yokes of the oxen that you can use for firewood. So I've got everything here. You can have the oxen. You can have the threshing floor. You can have the wood, do with it what you want. And then he goes on to say, may the Lord your God accept you. David, however, says, no, the only way I'm getting this is if I buy it. I will buy it from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing. So the bargaining comes to an end. David buys the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. David builds an altar to the Lord there. He offers burnt offerings and peace offerings. And then it wraps up. The book ends with this. So the Lord responded to the plea for the land, and the plague was averted from Israel. Now, this particular incident can't simply be viewed in isolation, because it turns out that this is a huge connection to what is to come. How so? Well, we're told, especially in the parallel to this in 2 Chronicles chapter 3, that this particular site is actually on, it's not just a threshing floor kind of around Jerusalem, but it's located on Mount Moriah. Now, Mount Moriah is the mountain that takes us all the way back to Genesis chapter 22. That's the mountain that Abraham took Isaac in order to sacrifice him. In fact, 2 Chronicles makes that explicit. So you got Moriah in Genesis 22, where Abraham almost offered Isaac, and there was a ram offered in his place. There was an altar built there. Now you have David building an altar in order to offer sacrifices to avert this disaster. And it's on that exact location where Abraham and Isaac were, where David is, that Solomon will then build the temple for the Lord. So we have this narrative connection between Genesis 22, 2 Samuel chapter 24, and then the later construction of the temple. So this place, Mount Moriah, then becomes the place of sacrifice, the place of atonement, the place where God's wrath is stayed, and there is a sacrifice offered on behalf of people. A ram offered for Isaac, sacrifices offered here to bring about atonement, and then sacrifice upon sacrifice upon sacrifice offered in the years to come at the temple, all in one way or another, to varying degrees, preparing for that ultimate sacrifice that is to be offered when Christ is Christ as the new and the better Isaac, Christ as the ram who takes our place, is himself sacrificed within the visible distance of the temple. He himself won't be sacrificed, of course, on Mount Moriah, but he's sacrificed in Jerusalem, because all of these sacrifices were paving the way for his sacrifice to come.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see this even in David's request. I mean, this is why I think it is important that he is talking to Jesus here when he says, "Behold, I have sinned and done what is wickedly." And then he says, "Let your hand be against me and against my father's house." Well, God relents, and God's hand will be against the one to whom he is talking to.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is part of his house. And so So God honors this request, but David is saying to Jesus, "I've sinned, so how about my house be punished?" And Jesus is saying, "Your house will be punished. In fact, I will be punished.
That will be the deal. Yes. I, the messenger of the Lord, who will become incarnate as the son of David.
Yes.
I, in fact, will be the one who is punished. And it will be then my body, the actual temple, the actual tabernacle of God, where this takes place."
Yes. Yes. And so, yeah, he makes a sacrifice. But all this is just pointing to the actual judgment of God falling on the house of David later, where the actual son of David is sacrificed for the sins, not just of David and the people of Israel, but the sins of the world. And this is why God can say, "That's enough. There's another way."
And because of all that, I mean, what a great way actually to end the book of 2 Samuel. You got the connection back to Genesis 22 and Mount Moriah, and then you've got to look forward to all of that which is to come. You've got Christ there. You've got David speaking of his house and the wrath that has come upon his house, and you have this propitiatory sacrifice that is offered, which is pointing toward the sacrifice that is to come. I'd say that's a pretty good way to end the book.
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's not too bad. And that is it. We have reached the end of not just 2 Samuel, but the end of this episode. Next week, we will get into 1 Kings. We're not quite done with David yet. So this isn't the way that we stop hearing about David. We're going to hear about David's very old age and how that goes down. But we're going to have to wait for next week when we get into 1 Kings, new book, Chad. Very exciting.
Yeah, I can't wait. It's going to be It's going to be fun. Let's put it that way. More wild stories coming up here about David and then his son Solomon.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see you then.